just remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Good morning, Vietnam, and good timely greeting to you, dear listener. Welcome back to our first full film review episode here at Play It Again, Kyla, of the new year. I debated about how to kick off 2021 here at the show, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I really wanted to review Wonder Woman 1984 because I have a lot of thoughts on that movie and I really want to get them out there. But I felt like in order to do that movie justice, first and foremost, I needed to review the 2017 Wonder Woman film, which is a film that I have been looking forward to talking about since starting this podcast. So I'm very excited for the conversation that's going to be had today. I was very excited to have the chance to return to watching the original 2017 Wonder Woman film after having seen Wonder Woman 1984. So I hope that you guys are going to enjoy the discussion to be had today. Wonder Woman 1984 is not going to inform a lot of the discussion that's going to be had today, but we are going to subsequently discuss Wonder Woman 1984 in the next episode of the show. So if you haven't seen Wonder Woman 1984, don't worry. We're not going to get into it in this episode, but it will be our forthcoming episode immediately following this one. So definitely go check it out if you haven't. And if you haven't rewatched the 2017 Wonder Woman lately, you should definitely do that as well. Because we're going to be really diving in and discussing what makes that such a unique and special superhero origins film. What is it about Patty Jenkins' creative vision that helped this film stand out amongst the pack of superhero films of the past decade or so? And we're going to really deliver a lot of hot takes about this movie. So I'm really excited, super, super, super excited to have Shay back on the show. She's one of my absolute favorite friends of the pod. So if you guys are ready, like, let's just go ahead and dive on in, shall we?
What is your mission?
To stop the war.
What war?
The war to end all wars.
Weapons far deadlier than you can ever imagine.
The war can be ours.
Whoever you are in more danger than you think.
I cannot stand by while innocent lives are lost.
Be careful, Diana.
Who is this woman?
She's my secretary, sir. She's a very good secretary.
It is our sacred duty to defend the world, and it's what I'm going to do.
Principles, although I am not opposed to engaging in a bit of fisticuffs should the occasion arise.
So here today to help me discuss 2017's Wonder Woman is a very special returning guest, Shay. Introduce yourself, Shay.
Hey everyone, I'm Shay. It's so good to be back. It's been, I think, like 6 months since I've been on Play It Again, Kyla. And it's been a wild 6 months.
That's the understatement of the century.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely been a weird time, but I'm here. I'm ready to talk about some delightful superhero escapism. Yeah.
Nice. What was your last episode?
Wasn't it Closer?
I think so. That's what I was. Yeah.
I think it was.
That's insane. And that still stands, I told you this before we started recording, Shay, as not only my most successful episode, but my favorite episode of the pod so far. So do you think we can top that here today?
Now, that's a pretty tall order. I don't want us to set any too lofty goals, but I'd sure like to try.
All right. We'll do our best. We'll do our best. That's all we can ask of ourselves, and that's all we can ask of Patty Jenkins, right? Is that she does her best with this movie, and that's what we're going to talk about. Did she do her best with this movie? And I feel like this is a very interesting time to reevaluate this first Wonder Woman installment in light of the controversies surrounding Wonder Woman 1984, which you have not seen yet, correct, Shay?
That's correct. I'm totally fresh, blank slate. Just rewatched the first Wonder Woman, but nothing to color my opinions, RE, the second installment.
Right. So for you listeners at home, this is the first of a two-part series we're doing at Planting and Kylo, where we're going to evaluate both the 2017 Wonder Woman and then Wonder Woman 1984, which of course dropped on Christmas Day of 2020. So I'm really excited for that double feature, and I'm really excited to hear all of Shay's thoughts. So this episode is a rewatch episode. Shay has rewatched Wonder Woman. She has seen the first Wonder Woman before, but our next episode, it'll be her first time viewing the second Wonder Woman film. So that'll be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be really fun to talk about both of them. I'm excited to see it for the first time and really get into it.
Yeah, so as is tradition on Play It Again, Kylo, when Shay is my guest, I have had to give her my HBO login once again.
I love to leech off all of your video streaming websites.
Mm-hmm. Shay has profiles on a lot of my family's streaming services. It's fine. It's fine.
That makes me an honorary Percival.
Exactly. But why would you want to be a Percival when your last name is Savage?
That's true. That's true. I could be both.
You could be both. You could hyphenate.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead, and before we jump into fun fact, Shay, I want us to each talk about our experience seeing Wonder Woman for the first time. Did you see this film in theaters back in 2017?
Yes, I saw it several times in theaters. I can't remember if it was twice or three times, but I remember going to see it with friends and then going to see it with friends again and then going to see it with my mom. So it must have been three times. And I remember being like being taken off guard by how hard it hit me. So like, I know we'll talk about like specific scenes and stuff like that later on, but I remember like crying in the theater and being really taken aback at when I cried, because it wasn't at any of like the more emotionally loaded moments. Mm-hmm. It was like in the scene that I know that we'll get to, where she's crossing no man's land, that I just kind of broke down and wept. And later, after, I was kind of like, why was it at that point that I was so, like, emotional about it? And I think it was just, like, the feeling of, like, sitting in a dark theater, like, looking up at a big screen, hearing, like, music swelling and, like, seeing this kind of scene of, like, intense power and it being a female hero. And, like, I'll never forget that experience of being in a theater and experiencing that. Like, it was really emotional for me. It was intense. It was so amazing. And it made me go back to buy expensive movie tickets two more times. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You've described my experience to a T almost, Shay. I saw this movie also three times. I saw it with friends twice, and then I drug my parents to see it. And it like, this is going to sound so corny and also like vaguely blasphemous. So I'm sorry, any Church of God listeners out there, but I stand by this statement. Watching Wonder Woman in a theater in 2017 felt like a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really did. It transcended just typical movie going, because it was something so special and so unique that I had never experienced before as a moviegoer. And I not to like go ahead and get ahead of ourselves here, but I really like just feel truly indebted to Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot for giving us that experience, because it was the type of experience that I didn't realize I was lacking until I had had it. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't, I always knew that, you know, most action films are filmed specifically through and for the male gaze. Like, I knew that, but I did not realize what I was missing out on by virtue of not being the audience for whom those films were made. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I remember a tweet that went viral back when this movie first came out in theaters that I think about every time I watch it, where it was like, wow, if walking out of Wonder Woman is what men feel like walking out of every other superhero movie, I understand the behavior of men now. Because it's like, you just truly feel endowed, like, with the strength to do anything.
Yeah, definitely. I was like, I could go throw a tank if I wanted to.
Exactly. And it was, there's something so special about that experience. And it's that part of the experience, the walking out of a movie theater and feeling like you can do anything, that recaptured something from childhood for me. Like, I can remember being a little kid and walking out of the theater and just feeling like I just had a truly transcendent experience seeing movies. Like, you know how, like, when you're a kid and you walk out of the movie theater and you feel like you've entered a parallel dimension?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what walking out of Wonder Woman felt like in 2017. So to experience that again as a 19-year-old, when the last time I had experienced that was probably as like a 7 or 8-year-old, and it wasn't even something that I realized I was missing, like, but there was a subconscious ache for that experience, you know?
Yeah, it definitely recaptures some of the, like, magic and imagination and sort of endless optimism and joy that you feel as a child when you get immersed in, like, really special and unique stories and worlds. And I definitely agree with you that I felt, like, surprised by the fact that I was moved by it, because I was like, I didn't realize that it was something that I genuinely felt like was missing from my movie-going experiences, from my experiences with media. I was like, okay, yeah, like, superhero movies are mostly for guys, but, like, there's other stuff that's for women that I like, so how much could I really be missing out? And then I went to see all the Marvel movies, and I saw them all religiously for years, and I saw the DC movies, and I was a really big fan of DC, and then, like, I was like, you know, I can have both things at the same time, this kind of guy's genre of superhero movies, and then maybe more stuff that features women and centers women's voices and women main characters and women directors and stuff. And then I walked out of Wonder Woman and I was like, why can we not have both? Now I'm like greedy.
Right, right. And that's it. What's so interesting about it is, like, I liked the superhero genre before Wonder Woman. It's not like I was sitting somewhere with my arms crossed being like, why isn't this for me? So I think that's what made it so spectacular and singular of an experience, was that, like, it just awakened something that I didn't even know was asleep.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good way to put it. Like, yeah.
And I wonder why this movie in particular, though, is the one that we all had this experience with. And I say we all, I mean, I'm talking for me and you, Shay. I don't know that every woman had this experience, but, like, this wasn't the first movie to like, it's not like this was the first female-led movie. It's not even the first female-led superhero movie. I do think that there's something about the juncture at time in which this came out. Like, this was when Marvel was just ruling everything, which now in 2021, I can say that with a little bit of, like, retrospective air, because there hasn't been a Marvel movie in a full year.
Nature is healing.
Exactly, exactly. But this was just, like, it felt like we'd been waiting so long for a female-led superhero movie. But I keep thinking back, like, this is after The Force Awakens by 2 years.
Right.
So, like, we had had Rey. And I also remember 2017, like, we had Beauty and the Beast. Like, we had movies that it felt like were being made for women. But why is this the one, or movies that were being made not just for women exclusively, but movies that were giving women a degree of ownership over the film that we hadn't experienced a lot previously? Mm. But why is this the one that struck that deep inner chord in so many of us?
Yeah, I wonder that too. I feel like part of it is I feel like we talk a lot when we talk about superhero movies of like the male power fantasy, which is like usually discussed as this sort of image of like a super beefed up, like jacked guy who like does the superhero power landing every time he jumps off a roof and is like super strong and like violent and stoic and that kind of thing. And I feel like Wonder Woman kind of embraced that sort of power fantasy, but made it a female power fantasy. So like she could not be anyone but herself. And mm-hmm. I think that her, like the way that she walks, the way that she moves, the way that she carries herself, the way that the score like reacts to her movement, the way that she like just occupies so much space in this film, it feels as though she is taking the place of that male power fantasy, but like adjusting it in a way that makes it like a little different so that she can occupy that space uniquely as herself, if that makes sense.
No, that totally does. And we're going to talk a lot about like how Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot creatively realized this vision for Wonder Woman, because like, not to be controversial on main, I obviously have not read every single Wonder Woman comic that has ever been printed, but I feel like there's something so special about the cinematic incarnation of Wonder Woman. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, there is a power and gravitas to this depiction of Wonder Woman that is just so different from Wonder Woman on the page or Wonder Woman from the Linda Carter television show, and that like this is the Wonder Woman that the moment needed in 2017 to now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not that like previous Wonder Womans all like necessarily didn't take themselves seriously or something, but like this one demanded to be taken seriously, you know? There was no space for like, oh, she's just like in kind of like her cute little like one piece swimsuit, kind of jumping around in her heels, like kind of cute little woman doing her cute little crime fighting. It was like a demand to have like the space and the energy and like her presence respected on the screen every time she's on screen. And I just think that's really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of discussion, I'm going to offer a few behind-the-scenes fun facts. I already gave you my favorite fun fact before we started recording, Shay, but I feel like I should build to that one because that one's just the end-all, be-all fun fact of this movie to me. But something that we were hitting on in our discussion just now is how this felt like such a singular movie-going experience for women, but this was not the first female-dominated superhero film. But this was the first female-dominant superhero film in 12 years. Elektra, which came out in 2005, was a female-dominated superhero film. And what strikes me so much about that fact is, like, we were living in the age of the superhero film. We're still in the age of the superhero film, even in 2021. But in 2017, the fact that Marvel had been cranking out multiple movies a year since 2008 and didn't decide to broach the subject of a female-led superhero movie. Like, why was that creative decision made by Marvel? Why did Marvel not corner the market with a Black Widow movie before Wonder Woman had the opportunity? Why do you think, Shay?
I desperately wish I knew the answer to that question, because I don't think it's for any kind of lack of appetite for it. I mean, which is obvious in the fact that Wonder Woman did so well, but also, like, people were asking for a Black Widow movie as soon as she was introduced to the MCU. Right, from 2010.
Yeah.
So it just seems, like, very strange and surprising to me, especially since they already had Scarlett Johansson contracted for, like, X number of movies for X number of years. It's like, I don't know, just kind of take a chance on it. And, you know, worst case is you make a kind of mediocre movie and people still shill out $1 million, you know, to go see it. And best case is you've created a really awesome movie and you get lauded as being like the people who knocked down the gender barrier in superhero movies. So I really can't fathom it.
It really just feels like Marvel handed this to DC on a silver platter.
It really does. It does feel that way.
I'm kind of eternally grateful, though, because don't get me wrong, I love Black Widow. I really do. She's one of my favorite Marvel heroes. But I'm glad that we had this experience with Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I think that this film really scratched an itch that I think a lot of us didn't even realize we had. And like, not to say that a Black Widow movie wouldn't have done that, but it would have been a very different movie because Black Widow is a very different character.
Yeah.
And she just has like a very different attitude towards the world, towards life. She doesn't have the same kind of like optimism, the same kind of like, you know, sort of blind love for humanity as Wonder Woman does in this film. And I think it would have made for a very different kind of first like break in the genre for women, which might not have necessarily even been a bad thing. It would just have been different.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. So Patty Jenkins, the realization of this film was basically her life's work. Like, she had been a fan of Wonder Woman for her entire life. Like, she loved the Linda Carter series as a child. She actually wanted Linda Carter to cameo in this film, which of course she did not. Sorry, Shay, spoiler alert. She eventually gets to make her cameo in the Wonder Woman films. But it did not happen in this 2017 version. But Patty Jenkins was actually originally approached by Warner Brothers to direct a Wonder Woman film back in 2005.
Whoa.
But the film did not happen at that point in time because Patty Jenkins unexpectedly became pregnant. And so she took a step back from her directorial duties, and the movie just kind of languished in pre-production obscurity for a really long period of time. And of course it wasn't until 2017 that it would eventually come out. But that kind of makes sense to me, looking at it, realizing that this film is like a culmination of like 12 years labor for Patty Jenkins and a lifetime of love for this character and her universe. Like, that just, that translates within the film to me, I think.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely feels like a passion project. Like, and it, I think it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about, like, the amount of respect that the movie has for Diana. Like, you can feel that Patty Jenkins respected this character and wanted to do right by her. And it feels like everything from the attention to detail, like, just really feels like this is something that the director and honestly, like, the whole team that worked on the movie really cared about.
Yeah, I completely agree. So Gal Gadot actually was informed that she had been cast in the role of Wonder Woman shortly after deciding to quit acting. That is like a great fun fact to me. I've always loved that. Now, of course, she didn't get the call specifically for this Wonder Woman solo film. She was actually cast for Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice. But could you imagine? You're like, yeah, I'm done with this. I'm not getting the roles I like. And I believe what happened is, like, she had made the decision that she was going to give up acting, and she got on a like long transatlantic flight back to Israel. And so she was like, yeah, I'm done, gets on the plane. And when she lands, she has a missed call from Zack Snyder, and she calls and they're like, hey, would you be interested in playing Wonder Woman?
That's insane.
I am eternally grateful to Zack Snyder and the powers that be within the DC extended universe that they convinced Gal Gadot to not stop acting, because I love Gal Gadot.
That is really crazy. I can't imagine just being like, all right, that's it. It's not working. It's not happening. I'm resolved to just go back to where I came from and do something else. And then, like, the role of a lifetime is just dropped right in your lap. Like, oh, hey, did you want this?
Does that not almost make you just convinced that divine intervention is a thing?
It sort of does feel like fate.
Yeah, it's like Gal Gadot was meant to play Diana Prince / Wonder Woman, which is something that we're going to discuss extensively later on. one thing that's, I remember reading so many interest pieces at the time, like when this movie was being filmed and about to come out, about Gal Gadot's physicality and the lengths she had to go to play Diana. And I haven't found like the exact number of calories, but I remember reading at the time, like it was an insane amount of calories that she had to consume daily to bulk up for this role.
Mm-hmm.
She trained for 9 months, gained like 17 pounds of muscle or something like that. Like it was a pretty insane amount. And then I just remember when the movie came out, people, do you remember when the movie came out, the two main complaints about Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman?
I gotta say, I don't.
You want me to tell them to you, Shay?
Please, I would love that.
I remember there being controversy around the fact that she shaved.
Oh, like her legs and her armpits?
Yeah.
I think that's funny.
I think it's funny too. That happened and I was like, okay, is that really what we're fixating on? And then number two, which this I feel like surrounded the release of Batman versus Superman more so than Wonder Woman.
Right.
But there was so much discussion about the size of this woman's boobs.
Oh my God. Why?
Because they weren't big enough.
What?
Yeah.
That's disgusting. I'm sorry. Like, okay, you know, shaving would be a little strange in this, like, Amazonian enclave of women where, like, they're all living in this, like, pure warrior state. I understand that a little bit, but, like, why are we talking about this woman's breasts?
There's literally a compilation. I'll try to put it in the show notes, and I'll send it to you later. There's a compilation of, like, YouTube videos where it's Gal Gadot, like, talking about her breast size for, like, 9 minutes on all the different late night shows because that's all anyone was talking about.
Ugh, I hate that. I hate that.
It's like the movie takes Diana seriously, but does the world into which the movie was released?
I don't like that at all. Mm-hmm. No more society.
Yes.
We've progressed past the need for a society.
No, you live in a society. A fun fact that I really enjoy, and I feel like most people who have watched any of the promotional material surrounding the release of this movie are aware that Gal Gadot and Chris Pine have a really great rapport as co-stars, and a lot of their interactions were improvised. I know specifically the pleasures of the flesh discussion on the boat, that was completely improvised.
That's a really good scene.
It's a great scene.
It's like they did such a good job of like hitting like excellent comedic cues while also like revealing some important character stuff really casually as well, like about both Steve and Diana. I loved that scene. I'm kind of delighted that it was improvised.
Yeah, isn't that great?
That is great.
I really, really love the dynamic between Chris Pine and Gal Gadot. I think that it's so hilarious. Like they're one pairing that, like, I don't care what movie they make together. If they make any other movies together, I'll watch it, and I will watch all of their interviews together. Like,
they have,
no matter what.
Yeah, they have just wonderful chemistry. It's really good.
It is very, very good. So yeah, I love knowing that they improvise some of that stuff. So one thing that's also very interesting is that the scenes in London are homage to the Superman film from 1978. And I love that Patty Jenkins is such a fan, not just of Wonder Woman, but of the genre and of DC, that she fit things like that in, so that it's like this movie just it has such broad appeal. I feel like it really, she made, I feel like she made it for, I feel as a viewer, like she made it specifically for me, but she really made it for fans of so many different things.
Mm.
So in terms of how she pays homage to that Superman film, you know, the premise there involves the protagonist, which is Superman, like being disguised in formal attire and stopping a mugging attack on a back street and not knowing how to operate a revolving door and things like that. And so I just feel like, you know, if you're a true diehard DC fan, not that this sounds awful, not that Patty Jenkins had more to prove than other directors, but you know there's such a, like, albatross around her neck, you know?
Yeah.
In going in as the first female director of a major superhero film.
Yeah.
And I feel like she just proved herself so decisively and almost so effortlessly, like, to the point where if you watch this and you are a gatekeeping type of fan, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, you watch it and you're like, no, she understands the material better than any of us as viewers possibly could.
Right. Yeah. I do think we have a tendency to kind of, as a society, look at people who are in a marginalized group, perhaps doing the first thing, whether it's like, oh, the first woman in space, or like, oh, the first Black person to integrate this school or whatever, they end up becoming like the banner carrier for their entire race or their entire gender or their entire like sexual orientation. And then like, it must be so much pressure to be the one person who's like, okay, this is the first woman who's going to direct a major superhero film that's led by a woman. And you know that there's a bunch of people waiting in the wings, if it stinks, to be like, oh, this is why women can't, shouldn't, won't be able to direct superhero movies in the future. And like, to be able to carry that weight with such grace, with such aptitude, and then make a really good movie that's enjoyable to watch, you know, mm-hmm. it's no small feat.
Yeah, no, it is not. And the fact that she succeeded so swimmingly, like this, I can remember, this is, we always reveal ourselves as the awful type of people who inhabit the land of Tumblr when we're on the show, Shay. But I remember a Tumblr post like a couple months before this movie came out being like, I don't care if you don't like Wonder Woman, go see it multiple times, because if this movie tanks, we're never going to get another female-led superhero movie.
Right.
Like, that was the narrative going in. And there were, I feel like there was discussion that there were like movements to get the movie to fail. Like, I feel like there was talk of like people like boycotting, and I know there were boycotts for like political reasons, like the movie was banned in Lebanon and other countries with which Israel has had, you know, history of armed hostilities or very cool diplomatic relations. Right. Like, there were multiple Middle Eastern countries where it was banned because you have Gal Gadot in the lead role. But then on top of that, I feel like there probably were, you know, currents running against this movie in terms of just moviegoers being like, I'm not going to go see that because it's female led, you know?
Right. And I think that there's proof in the fact that if you look at like the next major female led superhero movie, which was Captain Marvel, there was so much noise about boycotting and like, oh, ugh, I'm not going to go see that. I don't want to hear this, like that kind of thing. And that was like a major factor in the press surrounding the release of Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I just think the fact that Patty Jenkins committed herself so well that even with all of these odds being stacked against her, she released what at the time was the highest grossing superhero origin film of all time, which I believe has only been surpassed by Black Panther now.
Wow.
And the highest grossing film ever by a solo female director. Like, it's just insane how well this movie performed, both commercially and critically.
Right.
Because this was lauded by critics, too. It was selected by AFI for their top 10 films of 2017. Like, it succeeded in so many different capacities. Yeah. And my last and favorite fun fact about this movie, which I've already told you, Shay, but you can act surprised again, because Shay didn't know this when I told her this before we started recording, and I was very surprised because I feel like this was everywhere when this movie came out. Gal Gadot was pregnant during the reshoots for this movie, and so the fact, knowing that she filmed some of these action sequences while pregnant, is just insane.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna like act. I really am like again shocked.
Like, I can remember my second or third time seeing it in theaters, like trying to look specifically to see if I could tell, and I've never been able to on any rewatch to figure out, with not without having read about it. Like, I cannot visually just look at the picture and tell you which scenes she was pregnant for.
Yeah, absolutely not. And like, you know, she's just totally like graceful and strong and like the entire time. And I like can't even fathom moving like that minus being pregnant. So, you know, big chops, big acting chops. I don't know what I'm saying. It's crazy. I can't believe that. Carrying a human life while filming a superhero movie.
Is that not the most Wonder Woman thing you've ever heard, though?
Truly.
Like, Gal Gadot is Wonder Woman, as far as I'm concerned. She just is. So now that we've gone through all of those fun facts, Shay, I'm going to kick off the nitty-gritty of our discussion with the question that I always use to kick off our discussion, which is, what's your pit and what's your peak of watching this movie?
Okay, so should I start with the pit or should I start with the peak?
Let's start with pits. Let's end on the optimistic note.
Okay, so for me, my pit is the scene very close to the end of the movie. It's during the climactic reveal of Ares, where the shot is of Ares after being cast down, and he's like in a cave, naked and shivering, and it's just like Remus Lupin with his mustache. Uh-huh. And he's just like naked and shining, and they've kind of oiled him up, and he's like been given these muscles, and but he still has the silly little mustache and like the modern British haircut. It's unfathomable to me. I'm like, is this what you thought the Greek gods looks like? with a little mustache? It's, I can't.
Your classics degree is showing, Shay.
I know. I'm so picky over the classic stuff in this movie. I know we'll talk about the Ares stuff later. But the classicist in me is like, ugh. Mm-hmm. I don't like that shot. I think it's very silly.
It is silly. So that's your pit.
That's my pit. Yep.
I love that that's your pit, because I feel like when I always start with this question, but I almost wanted to omit this question this time because I didn't know what my pit was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a movie that even like the tragic beats land so well.
Right.
And inform the overall narrative so well that you don't feel like they're pits. And also this movie does a really good job of being, even though its runtime is pretty long, like it's 2.5 hours, it feels very briskly paced, so you don't get really bogged down in moments that could have been pits, I feel like. And I felt kind of dumb because I didn't even consider Steve's death being a pit. Like, sorry no. to Chris Pine, but I love him and I love Steve Trevor. I think Steve Trevor, which we'll talk about this later on, might be my favorite like romantic interest for a modern superhero, in terms of their cinematic incarnations. But I just, his death, the way it's handled, like it just feels like it has to be that way, you know? And yes. So I'm for my pit, because I'm basic and always want to go with tragic character beats for a pit, I'm going to go with Antiope's death. Because Robin Wright deserved more screen time. And that's the basis of that complaint. I was so hyped to see Claire Underwood in this movie as the leader of the Amazonian warriors. And so when she died, I was like, no. I was like, where? Give me more Claire Underwood, please.
She was only like a half an hour into the film, too. It was like, no, come on.
Right. It was really early. And then, obviously, not to get too bogged down in this show because you haven't seen the second film yet, but like Robin Wright is really highly billed on the second Wonder Woman, too. And I was like, oh my God, they're bringing Antiope back. And then again, she's in like one scene. And I was just like, what? I was like, give my woman more screen time, please. I'm going to write Patty Jenkins a strongly worded letter.
Yeah, perhaps for Wonder Woman 3, Wonder Woman 2024, they'll bring her back again and maybe give her 2 scenes this time.
Maybe. That would be really nice.
Yeah.
But what about our peaks, Shay?
Okay, I feel like my peak is super obvious, but I have to say it anyway. And it's No Man's Land crossing, and specifically the shot where she's taking heavy gunfire, has like sunken down to one knee and is like crouched and braced behind her shield. It's just like so perfect. It's such a superhero movie shot with like the music in the background and like the glow of the bullet fire, and like just her pose is so strong and perfect, and like this was the scene that like brought me to tears in the theater, so I had to go with this for my peak. It's just like such a wonderful way to like demonstrate her willingness to sacrifice, her strength, like just how much of a leader that she is. Oh, she's so good. It's good. I love this scene. This is superhero movies at their best.
It really is, and it's so good. And I'm glad that you mentioned No Man's Land, because when I was thinking about doing this episode and then when I was rewatching, don't get me wrong, I love the No Man's Land scene, but that's not the scene that got to me emotionally on my first watch. And so I was like, how am I going to give a peek that's not No Man's Land and justify it? So I'm really glad that you had that reaction to that scene, because I feel like that's emblematic of a lot of people's experience with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you that shot is so powerful. And one thing I've always loved, and one thing that I remember a lot of the discourse surrounding this movie, like harping on in the immediate aftermath of its release, was it's the fact that she does it with just a shield.
Right.
Like, it's the fact that she's not the aggressor. Like, right. she's just, I am crossing this. She says, no, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And she does it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so powerful. And I love what it says about power.
Yeah.
So I could spend all day just analyzing just that one scene. And I really do think that that scene is going to stand as like one of the best moments in any superhero film ever. Like, Patty Jenkins literally, not to get into the weeds of the controversy surrounding Wonder Woman 1984, but she could direct nothing but subpar superhero film from here on out, and I'd still be like, she still gave us the greatest scene ever. I don't care.
Absolutely, I totally agree. And like, it's such like, you know, when I was saying earlier about the power fantasy, like the fact that this power fantasy is the ability to bridge divides in order to save lives armed with nothing but like a shield and your own force of will and strength, like that's a power fantasy. It's good. It's just good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. My peak, though, I had almost the exact same reaction you had to the No Man's Land scene, to the scene of Diana taking the tower in the town. I think I was completely emotionally manipulated by the score.
Like, no, that's what so did good it. In the town. Yes,
it's so good, and it's just when she comes through the window or whatever it is she crashes through into like the little sniper tower.
Yeah.
And when she kicks out to sweep under the legs of the combatants, and it's the Wonder Woman theme hits at its loudest in that moment.
Uh-huh.
And something about the theme combined with the visuals, with like just being like, oh shoot, like this is Wonder Woman, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, I genuinely in this moment believe that this woman could do anything. And I again, why did you do that to me? Because I was weeping over like a comic booky action scene. But it was because her theme swelling behind that, and behind this might sound dumb, this is kind of like a random little thing, but I remember as a kid having a conversation with my dad about Indiana Jones. And don't get me wrong, I liked Indiana Jones, but like, and I still love Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is one of my favorite movies. But I remember my dad just being like, the thing about Indy is that it doesn't matter how many times he punches the bad guy or like how many crazy situations he gets himself in, like you're completely emotionally invested every time, but you know, despite being emotionally invested, like nothing's going to bring him down. He's always going to win. He was like, and that's the thing about Indiana Jones, is you know, he's going to come out on top. And I can remember being like, but why is that compelling? Like, what is interesting about knowing that your guy's going to win every time? Why do I need to watch four separate movie installments if I know he's going to win every single time? But in that moment, I got it. Like, in that moment, it all clicked into place. And I was like, oh, this is why my dad loves Indiana Jones so much. Like, because I know Diana's going to come out on top. I don't care how dire the situation gets. She is capable. She's going to win. But it's still compelling. Like, it still gets to me, and I'm still emotionally invested in every single scene of combat with her.
Yeah, I totally understand that comparison for sure.
So that was my personal peak. Now, Shay, I'm going to ask you, do you have a favorite shot from this movie?
Okay. Favorite shot other than her, like that one shot in the middle of no man's land. Mm-hmm. I feel like there are a couple that like really stand out. And one of them actually was in the trailer, I think. And it's her like walking into the party, the gala.
Yes.
With the sword. Uh-huh. In the back of her dress. And it's like, one, I think it's just a really cool shot, and like Gal Gadot looks really beautiful in it, so like it stands out. But it's also like this combination of like her being like beautiful and stunning and like just glamorous and charismatic, but then like underneath, what you don't see is the fact that she's like wielding this deadly weapon. Mm-hmm. It's just a cool dichotomy, and it really captures like a very cool kind of aspect of Wonder Woman and Diana Prince. And I just like that one. I think it's really neat. I it makes sense that they put it in the trailer because it's cool.
It is. It's such a good shot. I'm glad I was going to mention that one if you didn't. Like, oh, that. Good. There's just so many layers to that. Like you said, it's the dichotomy. It's the graceful elegance despite the brute strength that she possesses. It's like, mm-hmm. That's not a balance that you see superheroes strike. And it's such a delicate balance that I feel like only Wonder Woman can strike that well, you know?
Yeah.
No, it's a gorgeous shot. And then like, I'm sorry, you can put Gal Gadot in a dress like that. Like it's gonna work even if there's not poetic layers to it.
Right. No, exactly. Like, I don't care what it's saying to me. What it's saying is Gal Gadot pretty, and I'm
exactly.
taking in.
Exactly. there's one shot that I've always really enjoyed, and I don't know why, but I think that it, well, now that I said out loud, I don't know why, my brain is like, yes, you do. I like the shot of Hippolyta, like, basically holding court with Steve Trevor, like, and I think that I like because how often do you see a woman up on a pedestal like that, flanked only by powerful women?
Yeah.
With like the man in the foreground, like clearly being the weaker vessel.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't see it that often.
No. And so like, I hate to phrase it that way because it's not like I'm on this like maddening power trip watching this movie.
Oh, I am though.
Yeah, exactly. But like, that's such a, I just remember seeing that and being like, holy cow, those women are all so strong and so beautiful and so impressive. And I, okay, Connie Nielsen as Hippolyta is like A+ casting. I don't
yes,
know.
She's perfect.
She's so good.
Like that's an Amazonian queen. I don't know what to say.
She is. And so that, just that shot, and he's like wrapped in the lasso of Hestia, you know,
yep.
And it's just, oh, it's good. It is a little bit of a power trip.
I think sometimes going on a little bit of a power trip is okay.
Yeah, it is. as long as I'm not like doing that to men just randomly, you know,
random acts of violence on the street where you just exactly. pull out a lasso and
be like, Connie Nielsen did it, why can't I? WWCND, what would Connie Nielsen do?
That's really kind of my philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a really great shot. There's some really nice shots of London that I really enjoy. Like when they're first arriving, I like that establishing shot. So that's a good one. I like, this sound like it's such a cop out, but like Chris Pine and Gal Gadot are such an attractive couple that like any shots of them are just pretty to look at.
It's true. They're aesthetically pleasing.
They're very aesthetically pleasing. So I just enjoy, I love the moments in the snow.
Yeah.
I
think my second favorite one, and like this is kind of odd, but it's like in the seconds before Steve shoots, like he's in the plane and like flying to his death and he knows it, and it's like the seconds before he shoots in order to detonate the bombs, and he like smiles and closes his eyes, And that shot, for some reason, really sticks with me because I feel like it's a really important establishing moment for Steve's character, which is crazy because it's the last moments of his character.
Yeah.
But I think it tells so much about, like, what's important to him and, like, what's important to, like, us as the audience, too. Like, what has all this been for? And, like, in that moment, he's, like, facing down death, but he's also, like, I'm doing something that needs to be done. And, like, that last shot of him. And then we don't see him again other than in, like, flashbacks and in photos. So... I think that's a really good way to, like, put a wrap on Steve Trevor. I know just for this movie. I do know, yes, that he comes back in the next one.
You do, but you don't know how, and I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on that when we get there. But I agree. I think that that's a really good, it's a great, that's something Patty Jenkins does really well with visuals, and we're going to talk about her visual style later on because I feel like there's a little bit of controversy surrounding how stylized she is. And you described her as an auteur, Shay, which I agree with, but I feel like she's not everyone's cup of tea. But one thing she does really well is communicate character motivations visually.
Mm, yeah.
Like you know all that you need to know about her character strictly off the visuals. Like, it's such a George Lucas thing to say, but I almost feel like you could turn the dialogue off in this movie and just watch the images with the score and still get the entire story.
And I think that's proven by the fact that there even is that scene where Steve says goodbye to Diana, and we can't hear what he's saying until later, but, like, we know what he's saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. So, speaking of the dialogue, though, which I just said is inconsequential, but do you have a favorite line in this movie?
Yes, and now I'm going to sound like a broken record, but my favorite lines are the lines right before Diana starts to cross No Man's Land, where she has the exchange with Steve, where he's like, "We can't save everyone. That's not what we came here to do." And she goes, "No, but it's what I'm going to do." It's just perfect. It's such a good establishing moment for her character where she's able to communicate so briefly and, like, so eloquently what it is that Wonder Woman stands for. And it's not, like, any kind of high-minded, like, chess pieces moving on a board, like, world-dominating, world-saving. Like, she's literally, like, I'm going to save the people in front of me, and I'm going to do it every time. And it's perfect, and then the scene right after is perfect. So it's just an excellent line, a great setup for what comes after. And I love it. It's good.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's such a good line. And my favorite line, I feel like, is the other Diana line. Like, I feel like there are two lines in this movie that completely sum up Diana. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite thing in movies, is when you can point to one or two lines or actions and be like, that is that character. I need no other exposition. You can just give me that line and I know everything I need to know about that character. And the other Diana line is very importantly set up by a Hippolyta line earlier in the movie, which is when Diana is leaving Themyscira and Hippolyta says to her, "Be careful in the world of men, Diana. They do not deserve you," which is a very great line on its own merit, like, by itself. And it's a line that echoes throughout this movie and Wonder Woman 1984, which you'll see later on, Shay. But the fact that that line delivery early on in the movie leads to the culmination in the climax when Ares says they don't deserve your protection, talking about humans, and Diana says, "It's not about deserve, it's about what you believe, and I believe in love." Like, that's good. It. That's good. Wonder Woman. That's the good. Whole movie right there. I love it so much. I love it so much. And not to get all theology student on Maine right here, but one thing I didn't talk about in shots that has to be talked about at some point in this movie is, like, come on. There's a very clear allegory to be drawn between Diana and Jesus Christ. there are so many images in this movie of her with her arms outstretched looking like she could be crucified. And the one that springs to mind most viscerally and vividly for me is in the climax with Ares, when she's like up in the air, she's got the arms outstretched like that. And I remember when I drug my parents to see this movie, my cousins, Jen and Chad, went with us, and Chad is a minister and very involved in the Church of God. And we walked out and he was like, I could have done without all the Jesus imagery. And I'm like, dude, what? What? I'm like, I'm here for it. I love it because, like, it, you can strip it of all religious connotations. Like, it doesn't have to be about, it's not that Diana is Jesus, but it's just that, like, that's a message the world needs, that humans are so deserving of love despite their incredible capacity for good and evil. Like, humans are nuanced. Humans are gradient. There's so much rolled up in this mystery that is humanity. But in spite of all of that, like, humans may not deserve love, but some divine, I want to believe that some divine being loves us enough to sacrifice for us. And whether that's Diana Prince or that's Jesus Christ, either way, it's such a compelling and beautiful message. And that's, I feel like Patty Jenkins, you've used the word optimism so many times. She dares to be optimistic with this movie. She dares to give humanity hope. And that's not something a lot of filmmakers endeavor to do these days, I feel like. I feel like she deals with loftier themes than a lot of filmmakers do. And I appreciate that. It's gutsy, and I think it pays off in this movie.
That's such an interesting perspective, because I never really would have noticed, you know, I think kind of Christ imagery could slap me over the head and I tend to miss it, unless it's like the shots of Superman with like the halo behind.
Literally Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane behind him. Zack Snyder, you're so subtle.
And it's like, oh, I wonder what this is saying. Now that I can pick up on. But that's a really interesting perspective. So I'm glad you raised that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm here for it. Diana is, to me, one of the purest allegories for Christ we could have. So I really enjoy that. Again, not to dwell too much on my theology degree right now. But I
mean,
just,
we have to talk about what we know, you know?
Exactly. You in the classics, me in theology. Let's go.
Yes.
And this movie happens to have both.
Yeah, it really marries our two kind of special interests, I guess, if you could call them that.
It does, our special interests. So my next question, Shay, this I mentioned earlier, when this was released, it was the most lucrative superhero origins film of all time. And I think, critically speaking, it stands as one of the most well-received superhero origins films of all time. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is it that makes a good superhero origins film, and what makes this one stand out amongst that very crowded field?
Right. So I think that the most important thing, and this is pretty obvious, but the most important thing a superhero origin story has to do is to make you care about the superhero. And it has to do it in a way apart from, oh, this person has cool powers, or this person has like a cool future where they're going to be like, you know, fighting evil and battling aliens or whatever. Like, it has to make you fundamentally care about the superhero as a person. So what it has to do is pare down, like, who is this person? Why do they care enough to be a superhero? Why would they even choose to fight? And I think that this one in particular does all of those things. And then it also does the very cool and important thing and increasingly rare thing, which is that it doesn't get bogged down in introducing other characters too. Because I think that while a lot of, I like the fact that, you know, superhero crossovers and like big casts and stuff like that, like those movies are fun, but I find that it has led to a lot of the like solo stories becoming like just vehicles to set up further like ensemble casts.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not as compelling when we're juggling a whole bunch of different things. And there's a feeling that it's like, okay, we're only hitting these beats so that it makes sense when this person is doing X, Y, or Z in like Justice League or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that this movie is really, really good at making you understand Diana, care about her, like completely fathom why she is the way that she is and why she cares enough to fight on behalf of humanity without even concerning itself with like the fact that she was going to be in Batman versus Superman, or she already had been in Batman versus Superman, and that she was going to be in Justice League. It was like, we're not going to worry about that. Maybe an establishing shot at the beginning and Bruce Wayne gets to deliver her picture.
Yeah, but so like, fun fact, before rewatching this, and I've seen this movie at least 6 or 7 times probably, because I saw it 3 times in theaters. I know I probably saw it 2 or 3 other times in 2017. I've probably seen it a couple times since.
Mm.
But prior to rewatching, I hadn't seen it in like a hot minute, like probably a year prior to rewatching it for this episode. I had completely forgotten that Bruce Wayne is even like an entity in this right. movie. I forgot there was a framing device that involved Batman at all.
Yeah. It's easy to forget in this one.
Yeah, which is so good and so bold on behalf of Patty Jenkins.
I know, like, she was like, Batman who? And I love it.
Honestly, it's what he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, enough is about Bruce Wayne. We can have something be about somebody else for once.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, that's my take, is I think it handles really well the balance between like, okay, we need to establish this person so that they can be in this movie coming up, and it kind of is like, okay, I recognize that that's a goal here, but like, we're gonna do and say some other stuff as well.
Right. I think that Patty Jenkins completely made a film unto itself. Like, right. Wonder Woman exists to be a film about Wonder Woman. It's not setting anything up. It's not a chessboard. It's not how can this lead into these moments that are going to occur in a later installment. Like, this movie stands alone. You don't have to have seen Batman versus Superman, and you don't have to care about Justice League. Like,
and in fact, you ought not to see Batman versus Superman.
All right. Well, let's not get too critical of Snyder. He's going to save us, right, in March with the Snyder Cut.
Oh, sure.
So we'll talk about that in just a moment, I'm sure. But I appreciate that Patty Jenkins was like, I have a creative vision and I'm going to see that through. And I think that that's where so many superhero movies go wrong these days. And not to crap on Marvel. Like, I like Marvel, but it's so formulaic at this point that it doesn't even feel like it matters who is in the director's chair of a Marvel movie. And that bothers me. Like, I want to see someone's creative vision realized. I don't just want Kevin Feige pulling a bunch of master strings and like making the puppets dance, you know? Right. Like, and I feel like that you see that now in some Marvel movies that not even the actors know what they're doing. Shout out Gwyneth Paltrow for not even knowing what movie she's in.
But like, or who her co-stars are.
Yeah, exactly. They were like, you remember how Tom was there? And she was like, yeah. They're like, that's Spider-Man. She's like, oh. But I feel like we're so inundated with superhero content. It is hilarious to me that it was refreshing to have a superhero movie that was like, I'm just going to try to be about this one superhero.
Yeah, like, I'm really not worried about setting up a relationship with Aquaman or, like, getting any of these other guys up in here. Like, we'll worry about Cyborg later, etc. You know, I respect it. It was like, we're going to tell a story and you're going to like it. And you know what? I did.
And I think one thing that Patty Jenkins really succeeds at here in terms of the origin story is that she breaks it down to its simplest aspects, if that makes sense. Like, I just said that Marvel movies are so formulaic. She was not concerned with formula at all, which I really respect. I can remember as a kid, because I was obsessed with the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies as a kid, and I tried to write my own script for Spider-Man 4. And me and my cousins shot it on the Church of God South Georgia campground. I have no idea if that footage still exists. I hope not.
I hope it does.
But if I so I tried to write Spider-Man 4 and I tried to write other like original superhero movies as a kid, and I always felt like there were beats I had to hit. But of course, as like a 10-year-old, I did not understand like thematically what those beats meant. I just knew like, okay, the good guy and the bad guy have to cross paths at some point during Act One, but they don't have to know, like the bad guy doesn't have to be the bad guy at that point, but they have to cross paths. Then you have to have at least two separate confrontations, like violent confrontations with the bad guy prior to the climax. And then you have the climax where the confrontation is resolved. I thought that that's what made a superhero movie. And that oftentimes is what makes a superhero movie. Not that I knew everything about superhero formulas at 10 years old, but like I was on to something with that, even though I didn't understand like the nuances of the storytelling at play. But Patty Jenkins, I like that she doesn't have Diana confront the big bad until the end.
Mm.
Like that's kind of like there, it took some audacity to do that, I think. Can I call Patty Jenkins ballsy? That's what I was about to do. And then I was like, is that appropriate on the podcast? But I guess it is. But I was like, it's ballsy to me to be like, I'm not going to be so concerned with story beats that I'm going to sacrifice the story, you know? I don't know. I like that she stripped the purpose of the Origins film down and was like you said, like it's about telling people who Diana is and why Diana does what she does. And she wasn't even concerned with the villain. Like the villain didn't have to hit the beats that your superhero villain typically does. And I like that. I think it works beautifully.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. She definitely was like, you know, I'm going to tell this story about Diana and, you know, we'll see where we go along the way. And I think that your 10-year-old self was really precocious and onto something.
If I find the footage, Shay, I may share it with you.
I would like to see it. I would love to see it.
I do know that the villain... So my cousins that filmed this with me, they have a dog named Jimmy. They had a dog named Jimmy. Rest in peace, Jimmy. He passed away last year. But he was a pug. And so he was the villain.
Oh my
God. And we
called
him the Gymnastinator.
I want this. I want to see it.
So I'll text Joshua and Emily and see if they have it. Joshua and Emily, if you're interested in this footage being shared and you are listening to this episode, which you're definitely not, feel free to reach out with that footage. Anyways, now that we've given Patty Jenkins credit for being ballsy, let's just talk about her for a few minutes. Let's talk about Miss Jenkins. So one thing that I mentioned to you before we started recording, Shay, is that Patty Jenkins was initially offered the opportunity to direct the second Thor film, which became Thor: The Dark World. So since I told you that, would you like to see Patty Jenkins' take on a Thor installment?
You know, I actually would. And I know that some among us have very, very strong and positive feelings towards Thor: The Dark World. I have no real feelings.
Some among us.
Some among us who shall not be named at the moment have very, very strong positive feelings about Thor: The Dark World. I don't really feel anything about Thor: The Dark World. I think I've
positive or negative.
I'm so ambivalent about it. I think I saw it once in theaters. I remember Christopher Eccleston, who is a king among men, was in it.
He's Malekith.
Yeah.
Dark Elves. Yeah.
I think that's cool that he was in it. Because I think he's cool. But anyway,
you know who is in it that I think is cool?
Natalie Portman.
Yeah, okay. We made it an hour and 5 minutes without her name being dropped.
That's really powerful. I wonder if that's been the case the other times we've recorded. Definitely not with Closer.
No. anyways, continue.
Yeah, anyway, so because I'm kind of like ambivalent about this movie and I don't remember it very well, like I'd be really down with just like, you know, just do it again with a different director and just see how it's different. I think that's fine. We'll keep Natalie. She can be maybe a bigger part.
Fun fact, the reason Natalie Portman exited the MCU after Thor the Dark World was because they had not kept Patty Jenkins on board for that film.
Oh, no way. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's all coming together.
It's all coming together. But I just feel like Patty Jenkins would have had such a refreshing take in the MCU. On the one hand, I wonder if we shouldn't be a little grateful that she didn't ultimately direct a film for the MCU prior to Wonder Woman. Because, like I said, I feel like at the end of the day with a lot of MCU movies, basically every MCU movie post phase one, it doesn't even matter who's helming it, because like it's going to be, the strings are going to be pulled by Kevin Feige and Marvel and Disney. You know what I mean? Like the creative vision is not going to be just that of the director. But I would love to see a Thor or any MCU movie with Patty Jenkins having complete creative control over it. Like I would pay so much to see it.
It is interesting that out of all the Marvel heroes, it was Thor that she might have directed for once upon a time in another universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, per my knowledge of the situation, I speak as though Natalie Portman informs me of everything that goes on, which she definitely does not. But in my brain, that's how it works. So what my understanding of the situation is that Marvel approached Natalie Portman and was like, who do you want to work with for Thor 2? And she said Patty Jenkins. And they hired Patty Jenkins and then promptly fired Patty Jenkins.
Oh, no.
And then Natalie Portman was like, okay, goodbye, Marvel. That's a very abridged version of what happened. But I know that she has said publicly that she was going to make it like a space opera type deal. And I'm like, I'm here for it. Let's go.
A space opera would be cool. I'm into that. And also, like, I do think it's funny because, like, Thor is similar to Wonder Woman in that they both are, like, these ageless, very old, like, god or god-adjacent creatures who end up kind of stumbling into humanity, like, without really intending. And then they both kind of have this sort of, like, energy of, like, optimism and, like, conviction in their ideals and stuff like that. But then their paths diverge so much in where the characters have been taken.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's kind of interesting that, like, that might have been Patty Jenkins' fate to be stuck with these like god heroes.
It's like that's Patty Jenkins' sweet spot. She must direct the demigods.
Yes, it's gotta be the god heroes.
So let's bring it back to Wonder Woman. I guess I would love to talk about Thor the Dark World all day long, as you know. So on the subject of Patty Jenkins, there are so many things within this movie that, like, we've talked about how she had complete creative control here, and that's so obvious to the viewer. And I feel like there are so many things in terms of themes and in terms of cinematography and specific shots where it just, this movie lends itself really well to a female creative eye and specifically to Patty Jenkins' creative eye. So what are some things in terms of, like, themes and cinematography that you feel like Patty Jenkins did really well with this movie?
I wish I was like better equipped to discuss cinematography because I love it and I think it's really interesting, but I don't, like, I feel like I don't have the like tool case to like truly talk about cinematography as I'd like to. But I think that like one thing that's interesting to me about this movie is that it clearly has its own like it really stands apart from other movies in, and like I'll just focus on DC right now, in the way that it's shot and filmed. I feel like comparing it to even like Wonder Woman in like her appearances in Batman versus Superman and Justice League, it's such a different like vibe and energy. And I don't just mean in terms of like, you know, she is sexualized to a much greater degree in like Justice League.
Are we gonna acknowledge the Joss Whedon in the room?
I guess we have to acknowledge Joss. The horny is turned up much higher in Justice League. But I also think that like just like thinking about scenes that like really stand out in like a cinematic way. Like there's the scene where she's like wandering in the fog after the gas has been dropped on the town. And that really stands out to me as being really unique. She's like wandering in this fog and it's like orange and dirty. And I just really like that scene. I think it's beautiful. And, you know, in terms of theme, like kind of moving away from cinematography just for a moment, I think that one of the most important themes of this movie, and like they tell you this a lot, is that the theme of choosing your fate and choosing to do good. I think that in the end, like, Wonder Woman has made the choice to, like, there's the scene where she's leaving the island and talking with her mom. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, who will I be if I don't go? And that's her, like, fundamentally, like, drawing a line in the sand of her character and self. And I think that the theme of choice, and then specifically the theme of choosing love, mm-hmm. as like a radical act of like protection and care, is really powerful. Because in the end, like, obviously this is a violent movie and there are fight scenes and like Wonder Woman does solve problems using violence and stuff like that, but she also chooses to like decide to root that in love. And mm-hmm. I think that that choice is such a fundamental theme that like really comes through in this film and in the way that it's shot. So like with the difference in like the care and respect that like the cinematography treats Diana, and then also like this major theme of like choosing your own fate for yourself and choosing love to be that fate, I just think that was two really powerful things that kind of stuck out to me on this rewatch.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like, I just feel like it would have been really hard. I'm not saying that men are incapable of love. That is not what I'm saying. Disclaimer. But I feel like that theme of the quiet strength of choosing love and choosing optimism and never giving up hope in the face of ridiculous odds being stacked against you, and no matter the adversity, like, there feels like there is something distinctively feminine in those choices.
Mm.
And yeah. That probably has something to do with how the gender roles have been socialized, you know, and it's been ingrained in us that those are soft characteristics. And so I like that Wonder Woman kind of subverts those tropes in that, like, she's not soft overall. Like, she can still be a warrior and still choose love. But I just feel like these things needed to come from a female voice to work the way that they do in this film. So that's why I'm eternally grateful that it is Patty Jenkins who is at the helm of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
So, and not to just crap on Joss Whedon a bunch, but there are some shots where it's just like, it feels so much more empowering because you know that it is the female gaze through which you are seeing Diana. You know, I remember there being a post that went viral of someone who was very excited about the fact that when Wonder Woman lands at one point, you can see her thigh jiggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it just being like, that just doesn't seem like the kind of detail that a man would have focused in on with the camera, you know?
Yeah. And also like with the scenes where she's fighting, like, the camera stays like strong and focused on her, and it's never like panning up her legs,
mm-hmm.
or like panning up her butt or like panning up her chest. It's always like solid, strong, like direct on her while she like walks forward, like, or has her fight and stuff like that. And I think that that's pretty powerful too, like the stability of the shot,
mm-hmm.
contrasted with like the stability of the character, really establishes something very powerful, in opposition to like when she's on the screen in Justice League and it like introduces her by like starting at her feet and like making its way up her legs, and it's like, I know her legs are nice, but like, we don't need to focus on that right now.
I, as long as I live, will never forget the moment where there's a scene in Justice League. I don't even remember who she's talking to because it just ruined it for me. This one aspect overshadowed everything else in this scene. But it's like nighttime. I'm assuming she's talking to Bruce Wayne. I don't know. But it's nighttime and she's wearing leather pants. And the shot just stayed on Gal Gadot's butt for a really uncomfortable amount of time. And that was the moment where I was like, shoot, I need to go back and rewatch Wonder Woman and appreciate Patty Jenkins all over again, because there were so many moments that I didn't even realize could have been so sexual that weren't because it was her. You know what I mean? Like, there were moments where Wonder Woman could have felt so exploitative, but it didn't, because Patty Jenkins shot it in a way that was respectful of Gal Gadot and the character.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a million scenes where the Amazons were swinging up onto horses or jumping from heights, and all of those could have included upskirt shots, and none of them did. And I really appreciate it, because, like, really, it's, you know, 2017. I don't know when Justice League came out, because years feel like decades.
It came out just a couple months after this.
Oh my goodness. Like, the difference is unbelievable. Also, there's this scene in Justice League. This is not a Justice League episode, but, like, I gotta complain about this. There's this scene where Barry, like, face plants into her boobs. Like, this is an anime from 2004.
Uh-huh.
And, like, I can't let that go. That's a vendetta I have.
Shay, will you come on for my eventual Justice League episode?
Yeah, I will come on and just have, like, air my vendetta for the world about how annoyed I was that they had an anime style chest falling boob grab. Unbelievable.
I don't think I will ever be able to put into words what it felt like watching Justice League for the first time, because we were so fresh off the heels of this Wonder Woman movie. And I had such high hopes, because I was like, oh my goodness, I love Gal Gadot. I love the character of Wonder Woman. Like, I like Batman. I like Superman. I like Flash. I like Cyborg. This is going to be so good.
Yeah.
And then it just, within the first 10 minutes, you were just like, oh no.
Uh-oh. And
it really, I feel like, though, helped me appreciate the 2017 Wonder Woman film that much more, because I was like, holy cow. I did not. It goes back to, like, at the beginning, we were talking about how, like, this movie scratched an itch we didn't even know we had. Like, Patty Jenkins did so much that I appreciated that I didn't even realize I was appreciating it until I saw something else.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, you know, that's Justice League's own bad luck that it came out so quickly after, because it did feel especially like a slap in the face. To kind of retreat back to those, like, tired, exhausting, like, sexist tropes in filming and in character. And you know what? I was sad, because I do love all those characters.
Yeah.
I think they're cool. And
I was so excited for Justice League, because I'm more of a DC person than a Marvel person. Like, I like the character. I like, Spider-Man is my end-all be-all favorite superhero, but after Spider-Man, like, a lot of my favorite characters are DC properties, and I was so excited, and Mr. Whedon just really ruined it for me.
It's really tragic. I totally agree. Like, I love Spider-Man. I do love the MCU characters, but, like, my ride or die end-all be-all is Dick Grayson, who is constantly never allowed to be in movies anymore, which is ridiculous. Robin Wright is what I'm saying.
Nightwing's also
fine, but...
Nightwing's also fine.
But Robin is really where it's at. And I was, like, really just like, okay, maybe it's time. We're doing Justice League. Maybe he'll get a cute little sidekick. And that would be really fun, and they'll put him in those little tidy whities. I know they wouldn't, because, like, that's not the energy that they're going for in these very serious DC movies. But, like, get a little boy in there and have him do some catchphrases.
I want my boy. Sexualization, Batman. What are you doing?
I want to see my boy.
Speaking of Joss Whedon, though, have you read the Joss Whedon treatment for his Wonder Woman film that he wanted to make?
I, like, studiously avoided it. I was like, I can't look at this.
You are so blessed that that doesn't live in your head, Shay.
I was like, I physically cannot read this without just perishing, so I'm not going to.
Holy gag reflex inducer, Batman. It was bad.
I'm very thankful for my own, like, sense of protection for myself.
I wish I had more self-preservation instincts than I do, because I read it and it has haunted me ever since.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh.
I do want us to talk about the DC versus Marvel divide, but before we do that, I had one other thing I wanted to note on, like, the creative decisions Patty Jenkins made, which is the fact that this is set during World War One.
Yes, I love that. Shay? I love that. One, the outfits. Yes. Yes, give me a period piece. I love the outfits. I also really like that it's World War One and not World War Two. And I wish they'd kind of done a little bit more with this, because I think the really powerful thing about World War One as a historical event is that the bad guys and the good guys are a lot less clear-cut than in other major conflicts that, like, our country, the United States, has participated in, and in the other world war that came right after it. So I just feel like it was really a really powerful thing to, like, have it set during a period where, like, there were good guys and there were bad guys, but, like, they were kind of on both sides, and it was sort of a pointless war. So thematically it works with the, like, energy that they kind of brought at the end, where it was, like, Steve and Diana's conversation about how, like, you know, men make war in the end, and not just, like, men, but humans. And there are good people and there are bad people, but we're all kind of shades on a spectrum. And, like, different people can participate and allow atrocities to happen on different scales. And I think that World War One really, really works as a historical event for that kind of theming and that kind of setting. So, obviously, love a period piece, love the outfits. Yes, the aesthetics off the charts, but also thematically, it works really well, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it was a genius move by Patty Jenkins, and I feel like, like, you started by talking about the outfits. So, like, I feel like aesthetically, World War II has been mined so often that we just know what the aesthetics of that look like. And so, again, it was another ballsy choice on Miss Jenkins' part to set this in a different time period and mine different aesthetics that we aren't as used to seeing translated onto film. And then thematically, like, it just works so well because, like you said, in World War II, it, even though war is always messy and nuanced on some level, there it's so clear cut. Like, we know Nazis bad, you know. Yeah. Like, I mean, I hope we all know that. I hope we all know that.
It's 2021. We're taking the bold stand. Nazis bad.
Yeah, Nazis deserve to be punched in the face. And so, and more, but the fact that Patty Jenkins set this in a time period where it's not so clear cut, it's not black and white, it's just man against man, and that's so powerful, and it works so well for the overall theme of this movie. And I remember thinking that during, like, when the movie was released, I remember that being a conversation, people being like, oh, she said it during World War One, like, because it feels like every superhero movie and every war movie ever is World War II. You know?
Yeah.
And so the fact that she made the choice to be like, no, thematically, it's going to work better for me if there's no clear, like, oh, this is why this group of people is bad. Because once you lump that, it's so easy to dismiss, you know? And the, like, to be like, oh, these people are evil. That's it. They're bad. We're good. We're going to conquer them. But the fact that she played with these ideas of nuance and these ideas of how easy would it be for the other side to be considered the bad guy in this conflict, because we're all humans who exist on a spectrum of capabilities. We're all equally capable of goodness as we are of evil, you know?
Yeah.
So, good job, Miss Jenkins. I applaud you for that.
Good job, Queen.
So, now, like, we have to talk about the fact that this is arguably the only DC film that completely works. Like, can we say that?
Yeah, I can say that. I can say that because I like DC. So it's like, you know, it's coming from a place of love and care.
Yeah. Well, see, I prefer DC to Marvel cinematically so much. So, like, hot take, I love Zack Snyder. I think Zack Snyder is a really great filmmaker. I like how gritty and dark he makes the films, not just from a thematic perspective, but he also from a color grading perspective. Like, I just appreciate it. I think he is offering more originality to the superhero genre than anyone at Marvel. So I appreciate that. Sorry, Marvel fans, you can flame me. It's fine.
But no, no flaming. This is a friendly debate only.
Yeah, but so as someone who likes DC more than Marvel, this is far and away the best DC installment, right?
Yeah.
So how does this film shape how we view the DC extended universe, and how does it influence like the DC versus Marvel debate that filmgoers inevitably engage in the modern cinematic landscape?
Oh man, well, for one thing, it's kind of like, okay, you guys can clearly make a really, really, really good movie. So like, what's the holdup?
It can be done.
It can be done. Which, okay, that's not necessarily fair. I really like the Dark Knight movies. Mm-hmm. I think that they're really good. They're enjoyable to watch. They're good additions to the Batman canon. Heath Ledger's Joker is, like,
iconic,
untouchable. Mm-hmm. Vermont Senator Pat Leahy makes a cameo. Like, unbelievable. Uh-huh. But yeah, a lot of like recent movies have been kind of disappointing, and I do think there's a lot of different things that are kind of at play and at work there, so it's hard to kind of paint with a broad brush. I think a lot of people would say like, oh, it's because they try to make them too dark and they try to make them too gritty, but I think that if you're gonna lean into that like Snyder does, like, there's an audience that will really like that, but it means you have to fully, like, commit. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this movie does really well is fully committing to what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like, here we go, we're doing an origin story, we're doing a, like, female-led origin story about Wonder Woman. It's going to be rooted in this one specific period of time, and, like, that's what we're doing. And it fully commits to that. It commits to the aesthetics. It commits to the tone. And I think that that's one of the things that kind of makes it a standout. And, like, when comparing it to, you know, not to harp too much on Justice League, now I feel like I'm a schoolyard bully, like, kicking Joss Whedon in the ribs. But, like, Justice League's tone was all over the place.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I know it was because, like, it was recut and, like, different directors did different things. And, you know, I know all of that is the case, but, like, you still put the movie in theaters.
Yeah, so Warner Brothers, what were you thinking?
Like, you should figure out your tone if you're going to make me pay $8.50 to go watch it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that one of the things that this movie does really well that some of the other DC films, not all of them, but some of them tend to struggle with is that full, wholehearted commitment to what it's trying to be. And it's not like trying to walk this thin line between being a comedy and being dramatic and being sad and gritty and dark. And also, like, Batman versus Superman, I know, is a controversial film. I was so excited for that movie and was kind of let down by it. And I think part of it was just that, like, they tried to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
It was trying to be a lot of things. It was trying to be, like, this establishing film about the dynamic of the Justice League, about the dynamic between Superman and Batman, about, like, these high-handed kind of questions about the nature of being superheroes. And then they also wanted to fight a big alien.
Mm-hmm. And they introduced Wonder Woman.
They did. And yeah, they introduced like the concept of like these future films. It was just a little too much. And I was like, you guys needed to commit to half of this.
Let's be honest right now. What do you remember most from Batman versus Superman?
Tell me, do you bleed?
That's literally the only things that I remember, like, when I think about Batman versus Superman. And I say this as someone who, like, kind of enjoys that movie. Like, I own it. I own the extended edition on Movies Anywhere. Like, I've watched it fairly often. The only things that hold over for me for that movie are the introduction of Wonder Woman and Lex Luthor.
Lex Luthor was good. Okay, yeah. I will give the man from The Social Network that.
Hot take, Jesse Eisenberg is a great Lex Luthor.
He is. He's good. He's got good energy as Lex. And I love Lex Luthor.
I do too. And it's such a fresh take on Lex. Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
But don't make me say good things about Batman versus Superman on your podcast.
Sorry. You can come on for that episode and we can just like have like a debate over like whether or not there are merits to that movie.
Okay, I like that. I look forward to that.
Uh-huh. But I agree with you that I think what makes this movie stand head and shoulders above the rest of the DC canon is that it is what it is and it is unapologetic about that. And I agree with you that I think DC has an identity crisis. I think Marvel has a little bit of an identity crisis. Like, they know what works, but they're so committed to only being that one thing.
Right.
That they struggle for originality. DC doesn't struggle for originality, but DC does struggle for, like, cohesion, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think the thing that holds this movie together and allows the commitment to what it is to work is Patty Jenkins. But now we have to talk about the one thing that Patty Jenkins does that's, I feel like, fairly controversial in this movie, which is that final climax.
Yes.
And I know you have a lot of thoughts on that, Shay, so I want to let you just kind of have the floor. But before I do that, I do want to say, like, when I was, like, thinking about doing this episode and I was planning it out, I was talking to two of my friends, shout out Cadison and Shayna, if you're listening, and Shayna was like, I don't even remember Wonder Woman. She was like, I didn't like it that much. And I was like, girl, come sit down. Let's have a conversation. You are a modern woman and Wonder Woman did not affect you. And she was like, well, I only saw it once. And I was like, oh, because I do think this is a movie that it grows on you. Like, and I feel like seeing it multiple times in theaters was a really important part of appreciating it. Not that you can't appreciate it on the one viewing, but I wonder if I had just seen it one time and then walked away, if I would have actually been as emotionally affected by it as I was seeing it multiple times in the theater, you know? And definitely if I hadn't seen it at all since 2017, I don't know what that experience would be like. I just can't even rationalize it. But Cadison said that Act 3 of this movie just kind of falls apart for him, specifically because the final confrontation with Ares looks and feels like a big boss video game fight, which is something that I hadn't really thought too deeply into before he said it, because I feel like the bar is very low for DC villains. Like, we all know that DC villain concepts are just not usually great within DC movies. And so I'm looking at you, Steppenwolf. And so I just feel like I wasn't that concerned with the final climax, because I was like, oh, any twist is a good twist at this point. You know, like, I'll take the crumbs, DCEU. But I wanted to talk about the visuals of the scene specifically. Had you ever thought that it looks like a video game fight?
I hadn't had that thought independently. Now that you mentioned it to me, I can see it. But my problems with it were never, like, visuals based.
Okay, so let's talk about your thematic issues, and then we'll circle back to Patty Jenkins' visual style, okay?
Okay, that sounds good to me.
All right, you take it, Shay.
So I really like this movie. As we've established, my one main critique is the Ares storyline. And I know Kyla and I were discussing this a little bit beforehand, so we kind of have different views on this, which I think is fun. Mm-hmm. But I have, okay, here's my first difficulty with it. As a classics nerd, it's such like a Christian take on the Greek pantheon to have like this one like creator god, Zeus, who then has a son who's evil and wants to corrupt humanity and is responsible for all the sins of humanity, and then is cast down, and then they have an epic battle. Like, it's just such a funny like non-Greek take on the Greek pantheon. I've always like been mildly perturbed by that, just kind of from like a very nerdy standpoint, but it's okay. Like, I'm willing to be like, all right, for the purposes of this film, like, this is the pantheon we're working with. I'm okay with that. So like, with that kind of moved past, my kind of major like issue with the Ares plotline is that I feel like because it comes right after this really important climactic interaction between Steve and Diana, after she kills Ludendorff and realizes that it's not ending the war, and Steve says to her, like, it's because the war is made by not like one individual evil person. It's made by all of us as a society, just like making these choices. And like, he says to her, like, you might not have caused this, but like, maybe I hold responsibility for this. And we all know Steve to be a good man. So this is like a really important kind of growth moment for Diana, where she has to like grapple with the idea that maybe humanity is not simply corrupted by one evil god, but is actually just like ambiguous and difficult and sometimes cruel. And then unfortunately, like for me, I find that theme is somewhat undermined by the Aries reveal coming directly after that, because it's kind of like, okay, so then there was a big evil man whispering in the ears of all of these people all along anyway. So it sort of feels to me like it lessens the emotional impact of that conversation that comes right before it. So I sort of mentioned my like fan theory, like fanfics kind of thing to Kyla before, but I think it would have been really cool if they did really want to stick with a final climactic battle with like a big, bad, powerful evil. I think it would have been really cool if they started out with it being Sir Patrick, and then as she kind of walks around the outside, he shifts and changes form and appears in the guise of each of the humans that she's come to know. So it's not just Sir Patrick, it's also Dr. Maru, it's also Ludendorff, it's also Steve and their other friends, and it's also her. And like this shifting, changing face of war would, I think, encapsulate more what they were trying to say with the theme, while also allowing for like a big battle. And I also think it would be a little cooler than seeing Remus Lupin like kick ass. Oh, I'm sorry, I swore.
It's okay.
Kick butt in like, you know, some shiny CGI armor.
Mm-hmm, with his silly little mustache.
With his silly little mustache. It's so silly. It's so hard to take him seriously with the silly little mustache. And the fact that it's literally the exact same mustache as when he was Remus Lupin. It makes it really hard.
It does. They really leaned into the Remus Lupin comparison, I feel like.
They did, and they gave him a little suit and everything. Like, he looks like Lupin. And so, end rant, that's my opinion on the Aries kind of subplot. Purely thematically, nothing to do with visuals other than the silly little mustache point.
Here's the thing. Until Shay had told me about her concept for how she thinks visually that final climax should have gone, I had never considered that as an option. And now that she's described it to me, I would really like to see it. I would like to see Diana, like the concept of Aries become all of the people that Diana has come across in her adventures in the world of man. I will say, too, I would love to see Diana fight Aries as Etta Candy. Like, yes. Can you imagine?
Yes! Like, oh, it would be so good! It would just be really cool and, like, funny and good. Ugh.
It's such an interesting concept, but I do want to acknowledge that I have always really enjoyed the Aries reveal in this film, because I like the idea that the ultimate evil is clothed in the most innocuous, seemingly innocuous exterior. Like, I like the notion that the most nefarious and evil intentions can lurk in the least expected places, which I feel like reinforces some of the themes of what Steve's saying. I understand what Shay is saying about thematically it potentially undermining some of the reveals in that conversation with Diana and Steve, but I don't really take the Aries reveal at the end as being indicative of the fact that humans aren't nuanced because there is this one sinister force that is whispering in all of their ears. I just take it as like, oh, Aries is still here somewhere, because we've known that from the outset of the film, like Aries is wandering the earth, but humans are making these decisions independent of his influence, or because of his influence from eons past, not because he's forcing them to do all of these things. And I like that it's the who we thought was just like an affable, normal guy is the ultimate evil. It's interesting to me that it's a white British man with a mustache. Like, because we just, that's not what you're used to seeing on film. I feel like that it's, like I said, he's got the most innocuous exterior seemingly, but he is the ultimate evil. And so I feel like there had to be, we had to see Ares, and Diana had to have a direct conflict with Ares, because if there was no conflict after, you know, she kills Ludendorff and has her conversation with Steve, then like the movie would have felt anticlimactic from an action standpoint. Like there had to be some big bad confrontation. I like that Ares is a simple visual concept. Like, I like that there's not, I like Shay's idea. I do. It reminds me, though, of, like, the Percy Jackson description for Aphrodite, which is what I keep coming back to.
Yes, no, that's literally where I was at.
And so, but I've always enjoyed, as someone who is not a classics person, but instead a theology person, I like that the concept of Ares is so simple, and that there's not a crazy visual, like, thing for it. It's just he's a simple guy. Because I think that, again, reinforces the reveals from the conversation with Steve. So I was not aware that Shay had this hot take until right before we started recording. So now it's something that I just kind of want to, like, live with for a little while and think more in depth on and let it, like, ruminate within me. And then I'll touch base again when we do our Wonder Woman 84 episode on whether or not I stand by my initial reaction to the Ares reveal, which is that I thought it was very powerful to just have the seemingly kindly white man be the ultimate evil.
Yes, I would love to hear your further thoughts. And I also want to say that I do feel like when I first watched it, I had a very similar reaction to you, where I sort of responded in a very specific way with, like, oh my gosh, like, of course it's this guy. Like, we never would have, like, looked twice at this man because he's just, like, the most innocuous, like, under the radar flying individual. So I do think like there are definitely, I'm not going to say it's, like, awful and terrible and I hate it. I think there are merits. But I just think, you know, my very brilliant Percy Jackson-like idea would be cool, too.
I think Patty Jenkins should definitely hit you up for the third Wonder Woman film for concept ideas. Yeah,
come through, Patty. I would definitely love to do some storyboarding with you, girl.
I also, like, feel like when I first saw it, I was like, whoa, is Patty Jenkins making, like, a comment on British imperialism here?
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I was like, is that why it's, like, just, like, the white British man? Is that what she's going for?
Love a comment on British imperialism.
Yes, and when it's condemning it, of course.
Yeah, no, not a positive comment.
We love you, Lizzie, though. You're fine. You can stay. Speaking, though, of the reveals during the climax, Diana as the God Killer, that was another peak for me the first time I saw this in theaters. And it's not that it's not even subtle. Like, it's not right. Like it's super hidden or anything, but just the moment where she realizes it's not the sword, it's her. Like, that was, that was good back in 2017, and it's still good in 2021.
Yes, I think that's a really good example of a time where, like, it's set up early in the story. The audience can guess it. The audience does guess it, and then the payoff feels good. Because you're like, oh my gosh, I called it. You get the chills when it's revealed. And I think that we need to get comfortable with that again.
Yes, I agree. Things don't have to be unpredictable to be good or compelling.
Yep. And in fact, I would argue that if your audience can predict what you're setting up, sometimes that's a really good thing and it's proving you're doing good writing. So
right, exactly. Not everything has to be an Agatha Christie mystery. In fact, most things should not be.
The only thing that should be is an Agatha Christie mystery.
Exactly. Thank you, Shay. You get it.
Yeah, I get it. So I'm with you.
One final thing on the climax, though. Like, I feel like we got to talk about Patty Jenkins' stylized violence, like her approach to that as a whole.
Yeah.
Because one thing, I like it. And I feel like there are people who, I said earlier, it's not their cup of tea. But one thing that I appreciate about Patty Jenkins, which I'll probably go into more depth with this point in our Wonder Woman 84 episode, I like that as a director, I feel like visually a lot of the time, as soon as I think, oh, I wonder what would happen if so-and-so happened, or, oh, it would be cool to see this visual, then like within the next shot, Diana does it.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me. Like the way she visualizes conflict is so interesting to me. Like I love the visual of like Diana's wristlets, you know, I love her using those both defensively and offensively. I love like her sweeping the legs out from under people, like her using the sword to incapacitate the shield to incapacitate the gun. Like there are just so many things that it's like it enters my brain and I'm like, oh, it'd be a cool concept if this was what happened, and then Patty Jenkins just does that.
Right.
But she does it in such a specific visual way. Like you watch, I can watch, obviously I've seen them all before, but I feel like even if I had never seen any of these movies before and you showed me a battle scene from either Wonder Woman or Wonder Woman 84 and then a battle scene just featuring Wonder Woman from Justice League and or Batman versus Superman, I could tell you that they were different stylistically. You know, yes. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. She definitely has a very specific touch when she deals with fight scenes. And I think that one thing I like about them is that you can kind of see what's going on pretty well.
Yeah.
And I think that superhero fight scenes can tend to get bogged down in like slick camera movements and like random slow-mo and like kind of cutting away rapidly. And I would like to see, you know, what's going on in the fight. And so I do appreciate, like, even when she gets into the more stylistic, like, Diana dropping down into a low kick and it like goes into slow-mo with her motion and like that kind of stuff, it still fully allows you to like understand and grasp like, here's the terrain, here's who she's fighting, here's what's going on. I appreciate that kind of firm footing while also like dealing in the sort of lighter touch with details. I think that's very good.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I love her use of slow-mo.
Yeah, it is cool. And like, I do agree that like the special effects at the end are kind of a lot. Like, I like personally the fight scenes better when it's just more like person to person combat rather than like the kind of final scene. I just think it looks a little better, but that's okay. Like, I just don't really like CGI.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, before we move into our home stretch here where we're going to talk about Diana and Gal Gadot's portrayal, I mentioned the score earlier in our conversation about how I feel emotionally manipulated by the score, which is saying that it does its job. You know, like that's a high compliment for a film score, I feel like, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what it's supposed to do.
So do you have any other comments about the score before we move on?
The only comment I have is that cello stinger slaps. Nothing has ever slapped as hard as that, like, couple measure cello stinger that plays in the fight scene at the town in the final confrontation with Ares and then at the very beginning of the credits and at the very beginning of the film. It's like, yes, give me this cello. I love it. It's so good. It's so unique as, like, a superhero film. Oh, it's so good. And there's that video of the woman, like, sitting and she's playing it on the cello and it sounds so good and it's so cool. I don't know if you saw that video when it went around. But it's so good. I just love it. It's really cool and unique. Obviously they kind of deal in the normal superhero like brass and like drums and all that kind of stuff. You know, they're getting into it, but I love that they went with like an electric cello. It's just dope. It's so cool.
It is dope. It's so good. The score is so good. Like I could listen to the score of this film like independently, like just as music and enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to talk about the relationship between Diana and Steve, because I mentioned earlier that I think Steve Trevor possibly could be my favorite like romantic interest for a superhero character, like in the modern cinematic canon. So what do you have to say about their relationship? And do you agree with that assessment? Like, do you think that their relationship is one of the best represented romantic relationships in superhero film?
Yeah, I actually totally agree with you there. And I feel like it comes from, one, their on-screen chemistry, which is really, really good. And then, two, the fact that both Diana and Steve are, like, fully realized characters with their own goals and motivations from the moment that they meet each other. Mm-hmm. And they both have these opposing forces that are pulling them to do different things in the film. And there are a couple times where those things clash. And they have a confrontation about Diana being very upset that Steve didn't allow her to, like, confront and kill Ludendorff because he was worried it would jeopardize his mission. But in the end, their values and what matter to them are the same. So even mm-hmm. though their immediate missions might kind of pull them in opposing directions, their values bring them together. And it leads to this, like, really natural and believable buildup in their relationship. It's not just that they, like, immediately look at each other and like each other, even though clearly they're, like, attracted to each other at the beginning. It's like when they end up kind of getting together, you're like, oh, this makes sense. I understand why these two people like each other. And I feel mm-hmm. like, for some reason, that's really hard in action movies. Like, there's so many times where it's like a female love interest usually is introduced and she's put on screen with the male love interest. Eventually they get together and I'm sitting here like, why do these people like each other?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I feel like, not to make this about Marvel, but a lot of Marvel relationships, I feel like, rely heavily just on the fact that it's two supremely attractive actors, and that should be enough for them to have compelling chemistry. And right. it just doesn't translate every time, because I'm like, why do these characters care about each other? Yeah. You know, what is it that they bond over? What is it that they share? And so I really enjoy that Steve and Diana, like you said, we know who they are independently, and also, like, they both are committed to something bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They both have pretty soaring ideals for comic book characters, you know? And so I just really appreciate that. And I can't help but wonder, though, is their relationship bolstered by the fact that the non-superhero member of the relationship is the man? Like, does that make it easier for him to be a compelling character that is better served by the story? Like, and I'm not... Obviously, like, I have faith in Patty Jenkins that she would write a compelling character anyway. But, like, is the within the Marvel canon and within other DC films, even, are the love interests hampered because it's more difficult for these writers and filmmakers to give these female side characters compelling stories in their own right for some reason?
You know, yeah. Like, it's hard to prove a counterfactual, so, like, I don't think we'll ever know, like, if Steve Trevor was a woman, if he'd be well written. I guess the closest analog would be Peggy from the Captain America movies. They have kind of similar roles yeah. in the story, and, like, kind of similar jobs and that kind of thing. But, you know, I kind of don't care, because he's Steve and he's here and he's handsome and I'm gonna look at him and be bisexual and just enjoy life and be happy and blessed that we got two well-rounded leads, very unlike some of the other leads that we have had to deal with action movies. And, like, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Indiana Jones earlier, because, like, this is, like, a major problem in Indiana Jones. I'm like, why do these people like each other? Uh-huh. I don't know.
As someone whose favorite Indiana Jones is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, can confirm the romantic subplots make no sense.
It's like, why would these people even, like, stand to spend more than a couple minutes in a room together, truly? It's really funny. I enjoy the Indiana Jones movies just like you, but it's like, it's nice to have an action film where it's like, both of these characters make sense on their own and they make sense together, and I'm fine right. with it.
I feel like the Indiana Jones thing, though, is just like, oh, he's Harrison Ford, so duh, every woman wants to get with him. You know,
like, not when he's talking to me like that. Nuh-uh. Yeah,
exactly. But I don't know. And I'm glad that you brought up the comparison with Peggy, though, because I do think that that's interesting. And I hadn't considered that before. But I do feel like Peggy kind of stands in her own right as one of the best MCU romantic paramours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so if Steve would be comparable to her, then I feel like even if Steve weren't a male character, he would still be compelling enough and have enough merit on his own as a character to warrant the audience caring about him as much as Diana does, you know?
Right.
So also, I mean, Diana and Steve just have really good chemistry, which I feel comes down to Gal Gadot and Chris Pine.
Yeah.
And Chris Pine... I am always a Chris Hemsworth stan. Like, anytime someone asks me who's your favorite Chris, which for some reason is a topic of conversation in modern times, like, you have to have a favorite Chris, you know? Yeah. It's not what's your favorite book, what's your favorite movie, it's what's your favorite Chris. And usually I'll reply with Chris Hemsworth, but if I have recently rewatched either Wonder Woman installment or Princess Diaries 2 Royal Engagement, Chris Pine is my favorite Chris.
You know, I was 12 years old watching Princess Diaries 2 Royal Engagement, just losing it.
But like, Chris Pine, really, he's the most low-key Chris, but he might be the best Chris overall, if we're being completely honest.
I vibe with that.
Yeah. So as we round out this discussion, Shay, we have to talk about the woman who is wonderful, Miss Gal Gadot.
Boy, a seamless introduction.
Thank you. I've been sitting on that the whole time. Waiting for the moment to drop that one. Gal Gadot, thoughts?
Thoughts. Oh my gosh, where to begin? She's beautiful. And I'm gay. I feel like all of my episodes on Play It Again, Kyla, or me, like, talking about being gay at length, so I'm sorry to Kyla's listening audience. Anyway, she's beautiful, she's a great casting, just, like, from typecasting, like, she looks the part, it's perfect, and then beyond that, like, she embodies Diana Prince so well. It's the way she carries herself, it's the way she moves, it's the little tics that she adopts, you know, the little like head tilt thing she does when somebody gets a blow on her and she's like about to just go crazy and kick their butt. I just think that she really like settled into the character and embodied her in a way that goes beyond like physicality in terms of like looking the part and being gorgeous, and goes down to like a deeper understanding of who this character is, the love that she has for people, the love that she has for her own abilities and her own respect for herself and her own like ability to like kick butt and take names and all that kind of thing. I think that's all really amazing, and she brings that all to the table. And like, I know there's a lot of controversy surrounding Gal Gadot personally, but in terms of just character, like an actress playing a character, I think there really couldn't have been a better Diana.
Yeah, I agree. This is my hot take, and I've said this aloud every time I've watched either Wonder Woman movie, but I stand by this, and I want to hear your two cents after I say this, Shay. But Gal Gadot as Diana Prince / Wonder Woman is the best comic book casting of all time.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I vibe with that. I feel like, you know, you could argue like, okay, Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, but like, I don't like him as much.
I see. Here's my thing. There is something about the marriage of Gal Gadot and this character where it's like they both elevate each other. Does that make sense? Like, Gal Gadot rises to become Wonder Woman, and the character of Wonder Woman is bolstered by the portrayal of Gal Gadot. And usually that's a one-sided transaction in comic book casting. Usually either like the actor is more benefited by the role or the role is more benefited by the actor. But I think Gal Gadot is perfectly suited to be Diana Prince / Wonder Woman.
That's a really good way of putting it. I really like that perspective.
Yeah, thank you, Shay. you said it beautifully, but like, I mean, obviously the physicality is just there. Like, she looks the part. She's beautiful. Gal Gadot might be one of the most beautiful women alive. Like, I'll go on record as saying that. But she carries so much power and dignity within herself too, that I genuinely believe she could do all of these things.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like it requires no suspension of disbelief to me that Gal Gadot can do these things. And not to get into the weeds of the controversy, which we will probably inevitably talk more about in Wonder Woman 84, because there are some things that need to be discussed there with the controversy surrounding Gal Gadot and her politics and her role as a former member of the IDF. But her being a former member of the IDF, I feel like, does help her embody aspects of Diana.
Yeah, I think that you put it really well, where it's like it takes absolutely no suspension of disbelief to like look at Gal Gadot on your screen and be like, yeah, of course she's doing this. And the absolute opposite is true with Mr. Remus Lupin being in. What is going on with this man doing like these feats of immense strength on my screen? It's literally exactly the opposite.
I agree with that. Interesting that Patty Jenkins is responsible for both of those portrayals.
Really remarkable. You know, we all contain multitudes.
I was literally about to say Patty Jenkins contains multitudes. But speaking of multitudes, like Gal Gadot contains multitudes in her portrayal, in that, like you said, she's got the physicality down, but I feel like it could have been so easy for an actress to have the physicality down, but to lack aspects of the heart, mm-hmm. you know? Because she has to be so strong, and you have to be able to believe that she could pull off all these feats of incredible strength and resilience. But at the same time, she can come across as so soft and also as so naive.
Yes.
Like, how Gal Gadot manages to play such a self-assured warrior and then simultaneously play someone who is experiencing ice cream for the first time so convincingly. Like, that's just such an interesting dichotomy, and this is again one of those strange comparisons. Hopefully it lands as well as my Indiana Jones one supposedly did earlier. I remember watching Wonder Woman for the first time and being like, whoa, it reminds me of Jennifer Garner in 13 Going on 30. And what I mean by that is, have you seen 13 Going on 30, Shay?
No, this is lost on me.
Oh, dang it. Well, Jennifer Garner so convincingly portrays a 13-year-old stuck in the body of a 30-year-old that, like, she's, like, experiencing everything for the first time. And so, like, yeah, she's textbook definition of naive, but, like, also, like, I don't know, it doesn't feel like she's powerless because of that naivety, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the portrayal of the naivete makes her that much more, like, interesting and, like, I hate to use this word, but, like, adorable of a character. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, she's so cute. Like, when she's like, oh, a baby!
Right.
She runs over to the baby. It's, like, really cute, genuinely.
And so I feel like that's the comparison I just naturally drew when I was watching this for the first time, because I've never seen anyone convincingly portray, like, an out-of-body experience as well as Jennifer Garner. And obviously it's a completely different scenario here in Wonder Woman, but, like, someone experiencing the world for the first time, mm-hmm. you know? And she just does it really well. And so I don't know. Like, I think that Gal Gadot blows it out of the water. Obviously, like, I would watch this woman do anything, so I'm extremely biased. But I think I just cannot think of a better casting scenario than Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, Diana Prince. And I think it will be to the detriment of film as a whole if she doesn't get to play Wonder Woman many more times with stories that are as compelling and uplifting and important as this one.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And I think that's a great note as we wrap up as well, just to end on, really kind of puts a bow on top of the whole discussion.
I'm glad you think so, Shay. Ooh. So before I give the little closing spiel that I always give, I have three wrap-up questions for you as opposed to the usual two. So you're still going to get the usual two, which is this a film worth rewatching, and how would you convince someone of that? Mm-hmm. But then additionally, I feel like I know your answers to that because you have rewatched this movie multiple times, but still give your answer. But then on top of that, since you're going to watch Wonder Woman 1984 for the first time in the next few days, and we're going to discuss that, what are your hopes and thoughts for the Wonder Woman franchise going into that sequel?
Okay. I'm hoping that it manages to really continue and expand upon what we understand about Diana and her relationship to humanity. I think that's really important and is, like, at the core of the Wonder Woman story. So I hope that that continues. I hope there's some really cool costumes and some really good scoring. I think that'll be really exciting. I hope that there's an interesting villain. I don't know anything. Like, I don't even think I've seen a trailer.
What?
Yeah. So I'm totally a blank slate going into this. I hope there's a cool villain. And I hope that it like doesn't, you know, I've heard that there's some controversial elements. I hope that it doesn't have me look back on this with disappointment, and that instead, like, I can just kind of compartmentalize.
I will say, and this is me, so like obviously my experience is not going to be your experience. Walking out of Wonder Woman 1984, and I'm not going to say anything else about my impressions with that film because I want to leave that for that episode, so everyone listening, you'll have to tune into that. But the first thought I had walking out of Wonder Woman 1984 was, wow, I appreciate 2017's Wonder Woman even more, and I didn't think that was possible.
Good. Okay. I'm glad that that was your experience. I'm crossing my fingers, hoping that's mine too.
All right. So Shay, this is a film you think is worth rewatching, correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly.
And how would you convince someone of that?
Well, I think I would take one track if I knew that this person was a superhero movie fan. And I'd just be like, don't you want to enjoy a very good superhero movie? And leave it at that. But if I was talking to someone who wasn't into superhero films and was just kind of a total like newbie to the superhero movie genre, or didn't even like it and had decided that they weren't interested in superhero movies, I think I would just say that it's a really interesting movie from a completely like divorced from the superhero genre standpoint. I think that the aesthetics are great, the plot's interesting, the acting's good. And it's overall a fun movie that will leave you feeling uplifted and optimistic. And that's what, in the end, the superhero genre should do, I think.
Wow, Shay. You put that so beautifully.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I will say this is my favorite superhero origins film.
Mm.
So.
Me too.
We're full of hot takes today.
I know. We're like laying down just like take after take.
We really are. Patty Jenkins, please know we love you. And I'm not yet sure if you should listen to the Wonder Woman 1984 episode. Stay tuned.
We'll record it and let you know.
All right. So anything else you want to say before I officially end it, Shay?
You know, I think I've said my piece. I've said what I needed to say. I did what needed to be done.
All right. I'm proud of you. So this has been Play It Again, Kyla. This is our special first installment in our 2-episode Wonder Woman series. As always, if you have films you would like to hear discussed on the podcast, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again, Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find me personally at @Kyla_Z_Percival on Instagram and Twitter, and at KZP, yes, simply 3 letters, KZP on Letterboxd. Once again, this has been Play It Again, Kyla. I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off and saying I voted for Andy Kaufman.